The following commentary does not necessarily reflect the views of the staff and management of WBCA or Boston Neighborhood Network. If you would like to express another opinion, you can address your comments to Boston Neighborhood Network, 3025 Washington Street, Boston, Massachusetts, 02119. To arrange a time for your own commentary, you can call WBCA at 617-708-3241, or you can email radio@bnntv.org.
Hello, welcome to Life Matters. My name is Brendan O'Connell. Well, recently we've had some sort of bad news in New York, where they voted to have abortions all the way up until birth. Virginia governor had mentioned something about it, but it hasn't happened there. Vermont is talking about it, and even Massachusetts with the proposed Roe Act is considering changing abortion laws here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We have with us today the chairman-elect of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists, Ingrid Skop. She's a medical doctor and OBGYN, and she's going to talk to us today about can we draw a line on abortion after the first trimester? Because a lot of this legislation that's proposed is stuff that's after the first trimester. Well, welcome, Dr. Skop.
Thank you, Brandon, for having me.
Dr. Skop, you had recently had a paper that says, can we draw the line on abortion after the first trimester? Why that title, and what is this, the general thesis of this particular paper?
Well, I think that the average American, understandably, doesn't really spend a lot of time thinking or researching about abortion. It's a difficult topic, and I understand that. But unfortunately, what is happening is that there's very savvy branding and euphemisms to describe this. And, you know, we're told it's women's health care, even though, of course, it's not health care because it's disrupting a normal physiologic process. It's actually sort of the opposite of health care to disrupt a normal pregnancy. We're told that women need this. And I think most people say, well, you know, a woman wouldn't seek it out, particularly late term, unless she really did need it. They're content to let abortion be a decision between a woman and her doctor. And most people don't really understand the way that abortions happen in this country. Only 7 to 14% of OBGYNs will perform an abortion when requested by their patient. So most abortions are not done by a woman's doctor, but they're done by a technician, essentially, that she's paying to perform a service for her. And virtually all of these services are done for financial and social reasons. Very, very few are done for the reasons that concern us: rape, incest, life of the mother, fetal anomalies. Those are a very small fraction, and yet in order to justify that fraction, we're seeing legislation that permits abortion really at any time for any reason throughout a pregnancy, and that's actually a situation that's very dangerous for women.
Can I ask, what do you mean by social reasons that women are having abortions? For instance, in the first trimester, what is the most more common reasons? And then are those reasons the same in a second trimester or even a third trimester abortion?
The Guttmacher Institute does a lot of research related to abortion, and they've looked at this issue, and they have documented that women have late-term abortions for essentially the same reasons that they have early abortions. Reasons frequently given for late-term abortions are trouble deciding about the abortion or disagreeing about the abortion with the man involved. And I think that if we look behind those phrases, what we're seeing is that women often have late-term abortions because they're indecisive. They're not sure that that's what they want to do. And I think probably there's a lot of coercion involved. As an obstetrician, I know that it's possible, but it's not very common for a woman to really be unaware of a pregnancy until late in the pregnancy. So most of these women that present late probably know or suspect that they're pregnant, but they're just reluctant to admit that pregnancy to their parents or to their unsupportive partner. And I suspect that many of those late abortions are done for coercion at that point.
I see. Now, you've been how many years have you been doing obstetrics and gynecology since you graduated from medical school?
I've been doing obstetrics and gynecology for 27 years.
Wow, that's quite something. Now, I wanted to ask you, and this is a thing that that the pro-abortion industry, they talk about, oh, the fetus or the growing child in the womb doesn't feel pain until late in the pregnancy, but you have studies that say it happens much earlier. Could you talk about that? When does a fetus feel pain in the womb?
That's a very good and timely question. You know, I would say the listener should be aware that most of the mainstream medical organizations have a very progressive ideology. And so most of them have actually documented that we think abortion is good for women because it's a social good. That's sort of an inappropriate way for a medical organization to approach a medical issue. They should be willing to look and see where the evidence, what the evidence tells us. But unfortunately, what they try to do in order to justify abortion is they look at the evidence and they twist it around to try to say what they want it to say. In the instance of fetal pain, we know that a fetus, has pain receptors in the skin as early as 7 weeks gestation. Between 14 and 20 weeks, those pain receptors connect to the brain. They don't fully connect probably to the cerebral cortex until around the beginning of the third trimester, around 28 weeks. Mm-hmm. And so there was a paper in JAMA that said the baby doesn't feel pain prior to that point because he doesn't have the ability to emotionally process the pain. So that's a very extreme definition. I mean, we don't apply that sort of standard to lab rats. We don't apply it to people who have experienced brain death, to murderers on death row. They all get the benefit of the doubt, but the fetus doesn't get the benefit of the doubt. What we do know and what is well documented is that in the second trimester, if the fetus has a painful stimulus, if he gets poked, for example, with a needle during amniocentesis, he will withdraw from that stimulus. We will see him moving far. We will see vigorous body and breathing movements. They have measured endogenous opioids. They've been able to document that the heart rate goes up. All of the responses that we would expect to pain, we can see in a fetus in the second trimester. Mm-hmm. So anybody who tries to say that fetus doesn't feel pain is really just trying to justify doing an abortion at that time, but there's really no solid evidence to prove that that fetus does not feel pain.
And what about, and maybe you could explain, what is an intact DNE versus a non-intact DNE, and would there be a difference in pain?
So after the first trimester, 95% of abortions are performed as a DNE, which is dilation and evacuation. And the reason is the fetal bones have calcified at that point. That baby is fully formed, and so he cannot be removed with suction. An intact DNE is actually a procedure that is illegal. That involves dilating the cervix, grabbing the baby usually by one of his legs or and then bringing his body through. His head's going to be the most incompressible part, the biggest part. And so what they used to do is they would take big forceps and crush that skull and potentially suck out the brain matter so that they could make it smaller and bring it through the partially dilated cervix. Well, obviously, most of the time they did not do anything to kill the fetus first. So that sounds horrible, right? So that was there's a federal legislation that has made that illegal, and the Supreme Court did uphold that. But the second way to do a DNE, the non-intact, I would say is just as brutal and just as awful for a fetus, and that involves going in and just grabbing whatever you can find, which usually would be a leg or an arm, and pulling it off, and then reaching in again, grabbing part of the torso, pulling it out, basically extracting the fetus in pieces. Again, this is usually not done with feticide first, so the fetus would clearly feel everything until he finally dies. The The third way that a late-term abortion can be done, and this is usually the very, very late-term abortions, is by inducing labor. And again, they should perform feticide because labor is not necessarily going to kill a fetus. And you're aware, and I'm sure you've discussed it, that there's legislation at a national level in the Senate and in several states that says if a baby's born alive after an abortion, you need to provide it care because it's now an infant and it's now clearly, you know, a living human being who's outside of the uterus. No longer does abortion apply. And that has been met with a lot of resistance. And in fact, we're told that doesn't happen. Why do we even need to have legislation? That doesn't happen. Well, it does happen. And the CDC has reported a number of cases that have been reported to them where this happens because they don't want to bother killing the fetus. They know that nobody is supervising the abortion clinic. And they know that if the fetus inconveniently survives the labor process, that they can kill him after birth. That's a tragedy. We have now progressed all the way through pregnancy with elective abortion, and now we're performing infanticide, and we're doing it in an unapologetic way.
When you say we, you mean our society?
Our society. If you look worldwide, only 3% of countries will allow elective abortions after viability. So we're really in some very notorious company. We're right up there alongside China and North Korea in the extreme nature of our abortion legislation.
Right. And now, viability, is that 25 weeks, or have we made progress in the medical community?
It's lower than that. At the time of Roe v. Wade, it was considered 28 weeks. Currently, it's 22 weeks.
22.
So it's just barely over halfway through a pregnancy.
I see. Now, why don't we hear objections from medical societies about these sorts of things?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, unfortunately, most medical societies, because they tend to be academicians who have a more progressive ideology, most of them consider abortion to be a social good for women, and so they don't really look very hard to find reasons to oppose it. Unfortunately, my own professional organization, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, not the pro-life group that I'm associated with, but the other one, the one that almost every OB-GYN belongs to, has never expressed opposition to any. They have opposed every abortion restriction that has ever come out. So they have never said there's a situation in which we think it's not appropriate to do an abortion. They seem to have forgotten that they have two patients because they advocate for women, but they only will advocate for the fetus if it's a desired fetus. And the fetus who happens to be undesired, they are willing to throw under the bus, as it were. So it's frustrating. And like I said earlier, they don't ask their membership what they want.
Most OB-GYNs will not
do abortions.
They don't poll a membership like the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists?
The one poll that I know of found that only 7% would do it. So they don't ask us. They just go right ahead and
they make decrees from above.
Exactly.
I see. Now, feticide, that's killing a fetus. Is that being done more and more in our society?
Well, it can be done, and in fact, there's dozens of studies actually that show various agents that can be used. I would say probably the most common way to do that is to inject digoxin, which is a cardiac drug, into the amniotic sac, and it'll kill the fetus, but they've proven that it won't hurt the mother. I'm in Texas, and in Texas we actually did pass legislation that said if you're going to do a late-term abortion, you need to do feticide first because of the potential for fetal pain. And, of course, they immediately objected to that, and they said, oh, it's too dangerous, even though they had all these studies showing how safe it was. And as so often happens in this situation, a judge somewhere decided that it was an undue burden for a woman and set that legislation aside. So it does happen, but unfortunately many times it doesn't happen, and those fetuses do have the potential to be born alive.
Is this procedure, does it hurt women? There's a lot of different aspects. There's physical,
right,
emotional, psychological. Mm-hmm. What have you found in your years of practice?
regarding whether an abortion hurts a woman.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I have seen, in 27 years, I've seen women who have suffered all sorts of ways from abortion. I've seen women who have had infertility due to infections or to, hemorrhage or the need for D&C. I've seen a lot of women that have been hurt emotionally. And I think a lot of women, when they have an abortion, it's in response to a crisis, right? So initially they may say, oh, I'm good, I'm getting past this. And so for a lot of women, we don't see the emotional repercussions until years after the event. I would say it's very common for women to have a desired child down the road and to see that baby on ultrasound and then to think back to, oh my gosh, well, I killed a baby that looked just like this years earlier. And that's when they really start to think about it and to suffer. And there's abortion recovery groups all over the country in pregnancy resource centers and in churches. So even though the articles that the pro-abortion academic societies put out say, oh, we can't find any evidence of emotional harm, we see it on the ground all the time. It does sometimes kill women. The CDC is responsible for keeping maternal mortality statistics, but they only will investigate it if it comes to their attention, for example, on a death certificate.
What about death certificates? Because a lot of these, I know that the Shidlers had a thing of, they were chasing after ambulances where they would go after the woman would come out of an abortion clinic and go to a hospital. Are the death certificates accurate, or do the physicians even know that the lady had an abortion?
Yeah, death certificates are notoriously inaccurate. And we found that even in terms of maternal mortality, at a full term, only half of those death certificates reflect the pregnancy. And if we can't even tell when a woman dies with an actual baby in her arms, how do we detect abortions? Yes, most abortion providers do not have hospital privileges. They will not take care of their complications. So most of the time that is basically goes to the emergency room doctor who's on call. And I've been that doctor on a number of occasions. I have seen a woman who died from sepsis after an abortion. So I've physically held her hand while she died. So I know it does happen. Many times, death certificates are difficult to fill out. Sometimes it's hard to find the ICD-10 code that's appropriate. Sometimes there are so many events that occur that lead to a woman's death that the abortion initiating the whole sequence of events does not get recorded. And sometimes, unfortunately, whoever fills out the death certificate may be ideologically disposed to hide the fact that it was an abortion that initiated the cascade. There was a very good series of studies in Finland where they keep very, very concise records. And, of course, they have single-payer health care, so they know every woman and they know every procedure. And they discovered even there that 94% of deaths associated with abortion were not recorded on the death certificate.
Wow.
So when articles come out that say that abortion is 14 times safer than that 14 times safer than a term pregnancy, those are actually comparing numbers that we have no idea how accurate those are. And in fact, they're comparing disparate numbers. Abortion mortality is related to the 100,000 abortions. Maternal mortality is related to 100,000 live births. So the denominators are not even the same. Mm. And yet that study has been widely quoted to try to show that women should have an abortion rather than go through with a pregnancy.
And can I ask you about the risk of abortion the further along you go in pregnancy? Is there greater risk to the woman?
Sure. I mean, there's intuitive, it makes sense. There's more pregnancy tissue. I mentioned earlier how a D&E occurs. Mm-hmm. So if a doctor is blindly reaching into a uterus to pull out stuff with his clamps, he could easily perforate the uterus, which is softer the further in pregnancy it goes. Mm-hmm. If he did that, he could grab bowel, he could injure bladder, he could injure a blood vessel and cause hemorrhage. Dilating the uterus or the cervix can sometimes go awry. They can dilate in the wrong direction. Dilating a green cervix that is you know, prepared to hold a pregnancy in until term can damage that cervix. And we do have some good documentation that the birth of a subsequent pregnancy is more likely to occur prematurely, and in fact, sometimes very prematurely, because of that damage that occurs with the dilating process. One study showed that compared to an 8-week pregnancy termination, a pregnancy early in the second trimester had a 15 times higher risk of mortality for the woman. In the mid-second trimester, it had a 30 times higher risk of mortality. And after viability, the woman had a 76 times higher risk of dying from that abortion. So yes, these abortions that are occurring way up close to full term are very, very dangerous for a woman.
Mm-hmm. And now, what about the doing C-sections on women it seems to me that the health exception, you could drive a Mack truck through that. What is the case with C-sections as far as late-term abortions are concerned?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I wish that more people understood this. So the health exception allows an exception for emotional health, it allows an exception for age and social health, which are obviously not traditional health indications. So you're right, you can justify almost any abortion under the health exception. The reality is, it's not that common that a woman needs to be separated from her baby, but it does sometimes happen. I would say a scenario might be severe hypertension that poses a risk to the woman, or an intrauterine infection. If a woman needs to be separated from her baby, I, as her obstetrician, can do that. I'm not doing an abortion. Abortion, by definition, the product is a dead baby. Now, if I need to deliver her, I will, and I can do that by induced vaginal delivery or by cesarean, depending on which is appropriate. Mm-hmm. And if the baby can be saved, he can be saved. I mean, there are occasions that the baby is so premature that he does pass away, but at least he can do so in his mother's arms, and we can have perinatal hospice that can make sure that baby stays comfortable, and that is a much more compassionate way to deal with that situation than to send a woman like that to a late-term abortionist where she's waiting with other women who have healthy babies that they want to dispose of. And in addition, if she's that sick, if she really requires delivery because it poses a risk to her life, she shouldn't go to an abortion clinic. She should stay in the hospital where I have the emergency equipment and the ability to care for her if she should have a problem.
Mm-hmm. And do women really need second trimester abortions?
I don't think they do. I think that they have ready access to abortions early in pregnancy. So the ones that happen in later in pregnancy, second trimester and beyond, are generally happening, as I mentioned earlier, due to coercion or due to a relationship falling apart, which, I mean, that's a sad situation. I feel horrible for women that are in a situation like that, but it does not warrant killing a living human being, and that's what a fetus is. Mm-hmm. So really our society needs to decide, is this an absolute right that a woman has that for reasons of convenience that she can kill another human being? I was just going to say that 10% of the abortions in our country occur after the first trimester, and I mentioned the laws around the world. Only 6% of the countries around the world will allow an elective abortion after the first trimester. Even most European countries do not allow them after the first trimester. Mm-hmm. So again, we're pretty extreme in that perspective.
And would you say that blacks suffer more for abortion than other races in our country?
Well, they are certainly the race that has the highest rate of abortions. It's between 3 and 5 times higher other ethnic groups. They have 36% of the abortions, even though they're only 13% of the population. And in many areas, such as New York City, there are more black babies aborted than are born alive. These women, again, especially if they're done late term, they may suffer more complications from that. And we do know that maternal mortality is higher in black women. So there may be a connection there. Socially, I think women suffer because of abortion. The fact that it's readily accessible And the fact that it's widely talked about as a woman's choice leads men many times to say, if it's her choice, then I don't necessarily have to be involved in this. If she chooses to carry the pregnancy, that's her choice. That doesn't involve me. Since Roe, at the time in 1970, only 11% of babies were born outside of marriage in our country. You would have expected widespread abortion to lower. In fact, currently, 40% of babies are delivered outside of marriage, so presumably without a man around to father and to take care of the woman and the baby. And in the Black community, that number is as high as 70%.
Wow.
So unfortunately, Black women, I think, have suffered immensely socially because of easily accessible abortion.
Dr. Scop, our time is coming to an end, but I have one final question. And you were up in Vermont, or no, you testified in Vermont recently. What did you testify about, and would they be a state that would be a tourist state for late-term abortions?
Well, I mentioned a lot of the things that I've said today, but the Vermont legislation, as far as I know, is the most extreme legislation pending. And, of course, there are a number of states that are thinking about, you know, taking away restrictions and allowing it up to birth. But in Vermont, there's no supervision of the abortion providers. There's no... The woman doesn't even have to have a reason. I mean, basically anything goes. And yes, they would, with those extreme laws, people would come from miles around to go there, late-term abortion tourism, if you would. And with them not supervising and potentially having poor quality physicians, because again, nobody's really checking to make sure these are good providers. Mm-hmm. And abortion has so much stigma that for many abortion providers, it's kind of a career of last resort. You know, they may turn to abortion because they can't get hospital privileges or a standard practice won't have them. And mm-hmm. So if those type of providers are being unsupervised and providing late-term abortions, really late-term abortions, Vermont is going to see a lot of women die. And it's going to be very sad. I hope that they reconsider that legislation.
Right. Well, Dr. Scop, thank you so much for coming on the show today and experiencing, and telling us about your experiences in the many years that you've practiced. And good luck as chairman-elect of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists.
Thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed it. Appreciate
You're most
it.
Welcome.
Okay.
And
goodbye.
Folks, we hope you found today's show to be unique, informative, content-rich, truthful, and thought-provoking. Thanks for watching. I'm Brendan O'Connell, your friend for life.
The preceding commentary does not reflect the views of the staff and management of WBCA or the Boston Neighborhood Network. If you would like to express another opinion, you can address your comments to the Boston Neighborhood Network at 3025 Washington Street, Boston, Mass., 02119, attention WBCALP 102.9 FM. If you would like to arrange a time for your own commentary, call WBCA at 617-708-3241 or email us at radio@bnntv.org.